Hello, this is Informer, a show that reveals the latest ideas from artists, thinkers, and technologists. Informer invites you behind the screen to meet the people sketching, hacking, and imagining the next versions of our world. I'm Roddy Schrock, your host, and in each episode, I spotlight creative minds grappling with a changing world through art, technology, or often both. And I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast at informerpodcast.com, where you can also find show notes, links, and more information on all of the artists and projects that we discuss. Jesse Darling is an artist based in London and Berlin, working in sculpture, installation, text, and sound. I'm so pleased to be able to speak to them, as I feel their work only becomes more relevant as time passes. I first learned about Jesse Darling in the early 2010s. That was a time when a number of artists in my orbit were explicitly making a big deal about the fact that we were past the tipping point of the internet being a shared cultural experience. This group of artists flew under the flag of post-internet art, a term I always found to be a bit self-contradictory. How are we past the age of the internet when that is the thing that's being explicitly set in contrast? At any rate, I found Jesse's work, writings, and responses from that time to be illuminating, so it's a real treat to catch up with him today, and it's unsurprising to see that they've distanced themselves from some of their contemporaries of that period. Jesse's work has always been about fully encompassing human experience as the primary issue, rather than leading with a technophilic approach, as Jesse puts it. They describe their relationship to that period in our conversation today, as well as their continued dialogue with the machines around us. So on the line to Berlin, I began asking Jesse to share more about their early experiences with the internet.
Oh yeah, you know, the minute that the internet, you know, something, not even Web 2.0, but the minute that the internet started to become mainstreamed, I loved it. There was an internet cafe on the main road in my hometown, and I used to go there and log onto something which was called World's Chat, which was also a kind of like an avatar chat, a bit like Second Life. And now I think that the interface must have been extremely basic, but I liked it. I also liked computer games. I liked point and click, and there was something really exciting about that for me.
You know, as I think about your work and think about what you've written and so forth, I often get the sense that while you're not necessarily explicitly employing technologies like the internet or sort of referencing it in a very kind of direct way in your work, you're in kind of an ongoing dialogue with our relationships to technology, your relationships to technology, particularly when it comes to thinking through new senses of embodiment that technologies are allowing or sort of forcing perhaps at this point.
Well, no, I think it's totally, that's a very legit reading. I mean, maybe you know that when I started out in the, you know, art world proper, I did not make objects. Mainly I wrote texts and I used social media, and I sort of like turned my back on a certain audience and a certain reading of those things as work. I mean, the texts were kind of work, if you like. And in one of my texts I wrote, and it was kind of widely quoted at the time, every artist working today is a post-internet artist. And that, for me, you know, just holds true. And in that sense, there's also nothing that interesting about the condition of being post-internet. Or, you know, it's by now so much a sort of, I won't say universal, but it's so widespread an experience or a condition that, you know, very quickly I realized that the kind of, you know, the attitude of newness and radicality around it was just in some way reactionary, mm-hmm. Kind of celebratory of the wrong things, you know, was sort of technophilic and even a bit fascistic in terms of what was found to be exciting about the possibilities of the space. And indeed, some of what that discourse grew into was what I call sovereign paranoia, which is when, you know, mainly white, cisgendered and often heterosexual men who are also middle class kind of realize, oh, my body, my data body, or my etheric body does not belong to me. Without my consent, it's being parceled up, bought and sold. I'm being gazed at, I'm being surveilled. And then they evoke things like the commons. Once this all was grass, a kind of like primordial, you know, yeah, the garden of the internet, when before all the conglomerates moved into town or whatever. And to some extent, I'm sympathetic to the gentrification of the internet discourse, but on the other hand, I'm like, look, what commons? You know, you grow up as a woman, as a trans person, you grow up as a black person or a person of color in a white supremacist world, and the commons is not where you're safe. You're continually surveilled, you're continually gazed at, your body in a sense does not belong to you, and the history of the enslaved and colonized is also a history of personhood, despite the fact that, you know, the body was not one's own property, or at least was someone else's property, that what is the history of the body as property, right? So this is not unprecedented, and I absolutely reject the outrage in some way, even though it's a real thing that conglomerates are, you know, doing whatever they want with our data. But again, like post 9/11, there was a whole new world of surveillance came in, but not for those white guys who write about it. And largely they ignore that when they're writing about it, you know. So that's one thing I would say. This has also, I guess, informed my turn away from those discourses, that I found it also fucking basic after a while. Basic, reactionary, and bourgeois. And I think that's changed now. And of course, the like most interesting discourses around the internet are now not being produced from that perspective or subjectivity.
Some of the shift that you're pointing to is actually extraordinarily recent, and maybe just in the last few years. Are there theorists and writers that are inspiring you right now?
American artists, I think about Nora Khan. You know, there are a lot of people who are like, you could also say Cameron Rowland, who's working in fine art, not necessarily talking about the internet, but just talking about, I suppose, like how property circulates, and it does in a way refute this utopic commons. Certainly Nora Khan has, I think, explicitly written about that, and plenty other people too. And I think that I guess that, you know, on the subject of technology, I remain really fascinated with this category, you know, techno, that which is made. And I think, as I always say as well, you know, hammers and nails are technology as well. Bicycles, condoms, hormones. You know, to think about technology as the automobile and the aeroplane and the drone and the computer is also like a partial history of human, you know, technology. And of course, it's an imperial history, it's a patriarchal capitalist history. And so I also kind of wanna, that is very much something that informs my way of working and way of thinking. It's like anti-accelerationist. I'm an anti-futurist, but that doesn't make me an anti-technologist. I'm not at all a Luddite. I'm really interested in pretty much every aspect of technology. It's like a kind of magic in action, you know?
I love that definition of technology as magic in action. I think I'm going to start using that myself, if that's okay.
Sure thing.
That's great.
But you know what I mean, though? It's like...
I do.
We understand, but we don't. Yeah. We never understand enough. I also think that this attribution of the radical break or the sudden technological advancement of the West is basically a kind of racist narrative. So I would also say, like, provocatively, that, you know, playing cards are a technology. There's pretty much nothing that we do that is not. And that's the interesting thing.
Right. And that removes it from this notion of there being this radical break.
Yeah, totally, totally. And what's interesting as well, and I found this out when I was researching a show a few years ago that I made with the artist Phoebe Collins-James, that basically certain technologies that we use now have been in use for like sometimes hundreds of years, while other things just keep on upgrading, you know, your Apple products and your Android products and whatever else, your Nike sneakers and the various new kinds of machine weaves and whatever. But we've been flying the same airplanes since, you know, for probably now like almost 100 years. And dildos haven't changed so much in hundreds of years. I mean, you know, like there's so many counterexamples. And the one that I really like to use, which I learned from a book called, I think, The Shock of the Old, which is a kind of pop history book which counters the whole accelerationist perspective. There were more horses than tanks in World War II.
A word that keeps coming to mind for me is the word prop in thinking about how you work with objects. And I guess for me that was resonant in terms of looking at your work, because it is this word that means both an object that stands in for the real thing, but objects that are also supportive. And I wonder if that's something you think about in the way that you source materials.
I think so, but I think I don't think about it so consciously. I keep on thinking and thinking about the fallibility or collapsibility or fungibility of things, systems, bodies, ideas, and civilizations. And although I find this frightening and also sometimes sad, I kind of take comfort from the idea that nothing's too big to fail and that really everything is dying. Especially right now, everything's dying around here, you know? Like, whatever, the epoch is really, this particular phase is well on its way out, so that the pendulum's shifting and there's something new coming in. And it may not be pretty, but it is certain. I think on some level, you know, in the body or whatever, I think basically everyone knows that. And people are going, you know, are reacting in all kinds of ways, put it that way. And I think that the object is not to keep standing necessarily. When it comes to the idea of a prop, you know, we default to getting back up, and we default to dragging ourselves along and to basically to trying to keep standing, which is what we do. I think there's a tendency towards survival, or at least trying to survive, and it will be in the end always thwarted, but we try. And in this trying, a lot of things happen. You know, you could say that is literally what the human condition is trying to survive, where we will certainly fail. So this metaphor of like precariousness is, it's like, I mean, that's how I experience life. That's all I know of living, actually, that like nothing stays. You must never get too comfortable, because you know, you come in for a fall. And I think that this is like, when I think about making sculpture, I want to say that, but I also don't want to say that the fall is tragic. That's just part of it. You fall and you get back up and you try. And sometimes you fail. And ultimately, you always fail.
I have to say, one of the pieces that I was so happy to learn about as I was preparing to talk to you today was your work Gravity Road, which, if I'm understanding correctly, opened during the pandemic period in Germany. And I guess from what I learned online, it's essentially a roller coaster track that's bent out of joint and sort of winds back on itself at a reduced scale I understand also that it was installed in a subterranean residential swimming pool in a home that had been built during the Third Reich.
No, it's not a home. It was a swimming pool. It was built as a swimming pool. It's not really subterranean, but it looks that way. So you walk in, it's like street level, but there's also a balcony at the top. And the balcony would be just like, you know, I mean, it was the Third Reich, so the balcony from whence you can surveil or gaze upon the perfect bodies or the, you know, imperfect bodies of your fellow swimmers, like very reef and style, you know. But you walk in that place and it's got these big, like, you know, this sans serif fascist columns and the swimming pool balcony, and it really just, you know, I just thought, damn, you know, it's also huge, and the institution doesn't have a lot of money, and so this was also a problem of site specificity. Like, what can you do without much money in a really huge place that is somehow not too polite? You know, I felt like I really had to engage with what the architecture there, and not just pretend that like I wasn't standing in a fascist swimming pool, and make some nice stuff, and. The roller coaster, you know, steel is cheap, and my labor was, I think, like the people who worked on it with me probably got paid more than me or made more money out of it so far than I did, which is, that's fine, it's the way it should be. But because I was going to be making it myself, it wasn't like fabricated it. So that was the way to do it. And we just built it without any CAD drawings or like sketches. We like literally built that thing in the metal workshop bit by bit, and then put it all together, and that's what it looked like.
And how long was the piece up?
Like normal, you know, show length, but very few people saw it, which was fine. But you know, the thing about the roller coaster, talking of technology, and you know, this the affect of the moment. I learned so much about roller coasters when I wanted to make this roller coaster, and then I started learning as I was building it. And it turns out that, well, Gravity Road was the first roller coaster in Pennsylvania, and it was extrapolated, as you can imagine, from the mining train. And it's very literally leisure as a history of extraction. And I'm sure it's controversial to say this, but when I look now at what's happening in Silvan, in Jerusalem, which is being kind of cleared to make way for a theme park, and people being evicted by the military at gunpoint and made to demolish their own homes. There is also something about the history of extraction and settling, which seems to, you know, which continues and continues. This is modernity. And steel, of course, and metal ores are a big part of that history.
Well, I just spoke to Kate Crawford, who wrote the book Atlas of AI, which is kind of topographic map of extraction in all of its forms as the main components driving the kind of unfathomable scale of machine learning and big data and so forth. And her thesis is that extractive economy as sort of an engine for modernity is something that continues to this day, to the present, and our reliance on minerals and ores and so forth from the earth is at a level that it's never even been in any time in history. And I would, you know, and I think she even goes further to say that the idea of extraction is now being essentially applied to kind of our individual psyches as humans move from individuals to infrastructure, is the way that she phrases it.
You know, this the extraction has absolutely penetrated to the level of the psyche, and indeed level of the social, the, you know, transactional nature of relationships, and the kind of individualized, increasingly individualized, but also alienated developments in the field of work, the gig economy, you know, like the influencer, the OnlyFans. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with any of those things, or like I don't, the object of critique is not is not the influences or whoever, like the individual self as brand, you know, people who work those gigs, among other gigs. But it's just, I think it's true that it is a form of self extraction, you know. And that is becoming more and more prevalent.
Could you talk more about that idea of self-extraction?
Well, I think, I don't know, I'm actually still trying to work it out, like what it means for me, what it means for a certain generation, not so much my generation, but who comes after. You know, there's things that I feel like I can't fully understand about it. This is where it does become a bit generational, because it was not quite like that when I was growing up. But it is really like that now. And if I know a bit about it, it's because I've been working as an artist, and because I've been, you know, among other things, let's say, you know, a sex worker or an emotional laborer, in other words, you know, I've like worked some jobs which you would say tend to be gendered labor. I think a lot about the way that parenthood is taken up. I should say motherhood, even though I don't feel interpolated, but it's taken up as this extremely alienated and indeed extractive process. In which, like, the child ends up being like the product, because there's no other product to show for this labor. And I mean, it's kind of classic Marxist model trickle down oppression stuff, but this is now being understood as like, you know, this is now mother culture, you know, particularly online. I have a lot to say about that, and I'm very critical of it, but I think I'm not going to do it now. I'm still trying to get the right words, because it's kind of a sensitive issue. I mean, I don't care particularly about offending people. I just want to say exactly what I mean, and I'm still trying to work that out.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit maybe about some of your performance work as well, because I have also enjoyed learning more about that component of your work, and learning about Antigone, and I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that work, and also perhaps just how you approach performance in general.
Well, the first question, or the last question I can answer very quickly, is that I did used to think about myself as a performer, and I started making the objects because I was becoming, you know, over extracted. I was kind of flying around all the time in the emerging artist shuffle, you know, nice hotels but very small fees, always on a plane. I didn't pay for the trip, but I paid for it in energy, and I would always have to front up and be myself, you know, like on the road as the traveling preacher slash emerging artist JD. And it was just exhausting, and I just thought, I can't do this. I cannot. I'm not strong enough. I'm not man enough to do it, and I'm, you know, not good enough at what I'm doing to do it. Not a good enough performer, I had to admit, and not charismatic enough, and all the rest of it. So I started making these objects, and then I thought they can do their little turn. And in my first experiments with steel, I really was thinking very much about like what. How can I, like, fix these guys, these bodies, these steels, in this most uncomfortable affect? And they can just stay there. They can stay there. They can stay like that. It won't hurt them, and it won't hurt me. But there will be this sense of, yeah, you know, this is what it looks like when someone's got to be doing this eternal curtsy pirouette performance of the self, always, always, always on. And, you know, I mean, it's been much more recently only that I realized that you don't really have to do that. You don't even have to attend the opening or the dinner or whatever. And I don't. So that's that. And I think that as to the question about performance, it's a bit of a fraught question because I feel like my performativity was in some ways tied to I really like the word dysphoria, but I suppose I was trying to make the best of a gender position, and I don't have the same position now. I'm like hormonally probably, you know, mostly, well, I don't feel interpolated into the feminine these days. And increasingly the way I'm being taken up in the world is also changing, which is ambivalent and complicated and, you know, also a bit difficult, but it's at least different. And with the less femme I look and am, and maybe it's an age thing as well, the less I want to put myself in public. And it's really like something like the opposite of shame. And I don't know how to talk about that very well, except to say that, you know, doing porn at the age of 17 was not the thing that began it. It was like a symptom of, like, you know, the way I was living anyway, the way I felt like I had to live, the way that all girls have to live, which is kind of always in public and always in some sense conscious of what is of the performance that you're giving and how good an account of it, you know. So I think that I you know, I enjoyed some kind of online performance, or like the persona, and then after a while people started to talk about it as a persona, you know, my Twitter or my Instagram, and then I got pissed off and I said, it's not a persona, it's just, I'm just having fun online. Like, everybody's got a persona online, like your cousin, your granny, the guy at the fish shop. Don't make it a whole thing. I'm just like anybody else, which I also think is true. And I said that it was a sexist and reductive reading that nobody talks about Warhol's diaries or Voinovich's diaries as performance. There was just some kind of like a secondary practice of you know, of a larger art project. And I said, it's just like that. Don't get it twisted. Don't get hung up on it. And indeed, that seemed to, you know, that was a corrective. And then, yeah, the work Antigone is like the one work of its kind. And, hey, maybe I'll do it again someday. But what was really fun about it was that it wasn't really about me. There was a lot of other people in that performance. And, yeah, I mean, also controversial, I was trying to respond to the 9/11 myth through the myth of Antigone, who, of course, like, yeah, she is going to be punished for having insisted that her brother, like, the two brothers fight, one of them's buried, the other one is arbitrarily chucked outside the city gates to rot because, you know, somebody has to be an example. And Antigone says, no, I'm going to bury him. I want to mourn him. And the king says, well, then you're going to die for it. And she says, like, all right, I'll die for it. And I thought about, again, very on the nose, the Twin Towers, the two brothers, and who we are allowed to mourn. And, you know, yes, a couple of thousand people lost their lives in New York on that day. And subsequently in Afghanistan and Iran, in Iraq, many, many, many more thousands, you know. And those who didn't die have had to pay for it in other ways. And, you know, it's, again, this question which I often think about is who gets to be innocent, which is related to this sort of surveillance paranoia that I think about as well, you know.
I'd love to just know kind of what projects are you working on right now, and sort of what's sort of next in terms of your either public presentation or just new undertakings that you might be working on?
Yeah, you know, I'm really trying to do, I'm really trying to keep my head down a little bit at the moment, while keeping my job kind of thing. I really want to take some time to read and research, because I want to actually think more about this history of extraction. I want to think about something like, I think it has something to do with the European project to banish death. And I think that extraction and exhumation have something in common. And I think that the question of who is innocent is also related to the question of who gets to die, slash who's allowed to die, slash what is allowed to die, which is also a history of monuments, which is also a history of mines. And yeah, all right, so as you can hear, it's kind of a big thing, which, as you probably also hear, I'm really just pulling together really big swathes, and I need to sit down and think pretty hard. And I want to do it just because it feels like that's the thing. Like, there's a lot of like half-formed but strongly felt ideas that I have, and certainly it's time for me to start working in a different way. I feel like I have been basically like the self-extraction of my biography, my body, and my own experience has got to stop. One reason being that I'm just not as young as I used to be and I'm tired, and the other reason being that it's just not that interesting, and I don't want to go deeper into where I haven't gone already, because it's some things have to be private. And so I don't know, inevitably I'll find that it's autobiographical anyway in some way. But yeah, so I'm about to do a research fellowship, I guess, which is a kind of a ceramics fellowship, but I took from that, not, I don't want to think about ceramics. I did want to think about clay, and then I wanted to think about digging. So that's, thinking again about mining and quarries and pulling things out of the ground. And, I don't know. There is some shows coming up. I'm working on a show for the Drawing Centre next year, which also, again, I don't really know what that's going to be, but it's exciting to think about drawing as part of my public practice, because it's quite new. But I'm also supposed to be bringing out a book sometime next year, and the book is supposed to be a kind of, I joked and said it was a nonograph, like a kind of retrospective, but mainly of texts and written work. No docu and no like exhibition pictures or whatever, because no one cares about that. And I'm trying to figure out how to I'm thinking a lot about writing at the moment. And I used to do it much more, and then I really make a very strong promise to myself and to everyone else. Again, I did it in public, like I do bloody everything, or I did. And I said that I would no I would there would be no more contributions to the discourse. And I kept up this promise, and then the discourse kind of changed. And it's not that I feel now like that I must contribute to the discourse, but I only ever wrote and spoke when I thought that I had to say something, because I didn't see it being said. And I'm starting to have that feeling again, that there's a few things that I'm like, all right, waiting for someone to articulate what I want to hear said, and no one's said it yet. And if they do, then great, I don't have to do it.
Well, thank you so much, Jesse. I think that's a great place to leave the conversation today. And I want to remind everyone that you can find notes and links at the website informerpodcast.com. Until next time, thanks for joining me at Informer, and I hope that you'll join us again.